This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, welcome. We have a special episode today live here at Tractor Tuesday Live with Scott Anderson of New Age Ag Supply and the most important Scott today in the room, Scott Sheldy, a.k.a. the Cow Guy, joining us from Nashville. Scott, how you doing down there?
I'm great. Nashville's treated us well. We've been here 4.5 years. We're enjoying our time. I've never really been in the South before. I mean, I'm from Chicago. I do have a place in Arizona, but it's been interesting, and we've adapted, so it's a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah, and I had the pleasure of meeting Scott about a year ago. I was down in RFD TV studios. I think it was in November, and first time, and you know, my old man had met you back probably Mercantile, maybe Board of Trade, some sort of trip in Chicago in 13, and had a lot of positive things to say about you. And, you know, more and more, we try to tune in as much as we can during the business day to try to get a grasp of what's going on in the world. But I mean, really, it's a tough one. And I'm not exactly sure which way is up anymore. And the deeper I get into farming and losing money, the more confused I am with the markets. So that's kind of where we're at. But, you know, outside of all of this, Scott, you know, you've got a really amazing origin story. And just wanted to touch a little bit on more of your background. And, you know, I know that you were born, I think, on the Iowa side of the river, but then ended up moving over to the Illinois side of it all.
Yeah, my parents met at Drake University. My dad played football there, but out of college, he got a job with Cargill in Des Moines.
Okay.
And then I came along. I was born. Then shortly thereafter, 18 months later, my brother was born. And then Cargill transferred my father up to Lake Minnetonka to the home office. And from there, he was transferred down to Chicago in real early 70s, 71-ish, maybe, I would say. And he stayed in Chicago, you know, for the rest of our time. That's where I cut my teeth in the business. But he was with Cargill until probably 1974. Okay. He went on his own. And yeah. Then when I was able to start trading in 1988, I came out of the University of Colorado and with my finance degree, and the rest is history. But the funny parts of the story are is that my father, when he got the job in Des Moines, Cargill put him on the on the salt sales team, like road salt sales.
Yeah.
And he was given a 4 or 5 state area and a company car. And on the way back from, say, Ohio and Indiana, he ran around the Lake Michigan area near Chicago. And he noticed a real big building on the lake. And as you could back in the day, you know, with your Cargill badge or your Cargill folder, you could get up to see the procurement manager. And he didn't really know what building it was in, but he just knew it was massive.
Yeah.
As it turns out, it was U.S. Steel, and he made the sale for Cargill Salt to U.S. Steel, and that was good enough for a promotion up to the home office in Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And then they transferred him to Chicago when they started something called CIS, Cargill Investor Services. He was made the vice president, and unfortunately, though, the president was a friend of his, and also they were exact same age.
Oh, wow.
So in 1976, in the spring of 76, my father went to, his name was Dan Amstutz, and said, "Dan, you know, I can wait until you retire, and then I'll be president for 6 months, and then I'll retire. Mm-hmm. So I'll be, you know, I'm going to be the oldest vice president in the history of the U.S., or I can take this new offer I have to do a big part of the wheat corn spread, which was very popular in Chicago at the time, and go on my own." And so they wished him well. But, you know, because he worked at Cargill's famous for, don't get me wrong, I like Cargill, but they're famous for, they don't pay as well, but you'll never be fired. It's kind of like working for the government, right?
Right.
And my dad said he made so much money his first month doing the wheat side of a corn wheat spread for a big broker in Chicago that he felt too guilty to go back to his going away party, so he didn't go. But anyway, the story is that in November of 76, that his buddy, got a big government job with Secretary of Agriculture and resigned as the president of CIS. So had my dad waited 6 months, he would have been the president. But everybody won on that trade because my father went on his own, and it was much, much, much more profitable to be working for yourself even back then. And so that's how I got in the business. My dad was on the floor, and I thought I'd give it a shot to get it out of my system. I didn't know if I'd be any good at it, but my brother and sister didn't really want to go into it. I tried, and the rest is history. Here I am.
Well, hey, so my question was, did you finish your high school career in Illinois, or were you already? Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure, because I knew one of the big accomplishments that, you know, you had an opportunity and you played a little bit of football over there in Boulder. For Nebraskans, that's kind of a loaded statement there. You know, it's just a little bit interesting, and we may had some, you know, family or buddies that were at war with you. But yeah, I mean, if you can kind of summarize, how did you make the decision to end up going out to Boulder?
Well, I was going to play football, and this is back in the day before they really recruited, right? I mean,
yeah,
this is the early 80s, and Big Ten only really recruited the Illinois, right? It wasn't, you know, I got recruited by Tennessee and Vanderbilt, but I didn't know what the SEC was. And I was like, right. What is a Commodore? What's a volunteer? I'm not going there. Yeah. And that's to say I was that good enough to go, you know, that they would have ultimately offered me. That's, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But when I took a visit to Northwestern, and I always lied about my height because I'm short. I'm 6'1".
Yeah.
And for a D lineman and D1 ball, they want you to be 6'3". And mm-hmm. I was always wearing cowboy boots and trying to fluff my way through, and everybody could see through it.
Yeah.
My best story is when I went up to Northwestern and I got out of the limo, and Dennis Green saw exactly how high, you know, remember Dennis Green, he used to be head coach of the Cardinals, and but he was head coach of Northwestern at the time in the 80s. He was so angry that I lied about my height. He made me sit with the band, not with the other recruits for the game.
Oh my goodness.
So, when I didn't get any offers from the places that I wanted to go to in the Midwest, we wrote to Colorado, because that was, for some reason, I just loved the mountains.
Yeah.
And Colorado, this is after National Letter of Intent Day, whatever they call it now.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, we don't have any scholarships left, but if you could come out and make the team, we'll give you some money.
Okay.
So that's all I need I just want an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I made the team. I made the traveling team, actually. And the rest is history there. But I got hurt, played only 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I wasn't very good. I was kind of like the Rudy of the University of Colorado football team. but it was just great to get away and meet different people. And you're right. You know, Nebraska was a big rivalry. And there was a few guys on our team from Nebraska, by the way.
Yeah,
you know, Scott's Bluff and mm-hmm. you know, Kearney or Omaha. But my father found out that when I went to school there, I had decent grades in high school, you know, not an A+ average, but the Boulder Business School, I couldn't get into with my grades out of college. Mm-hmm. I'm out of high school. So, but I was, my mother on my mom's side, she's got some famous artists, American artists in her family, like bona fide famous artists, like they've shown at the New York Smithsonian and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually got into the art school in Boulder.
Oh,
I'll never forget my dad flying out to watch us play UCLA at home.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could do was stand next to the coach. I wasn't going to get in. I just wanted to be by the coach in case the TV cameras were on the coach, they'd see me.
Yeah, right.
And
great strategy.
And after the game, it was a beautiful day in Boulder, you know, sunny and 75.
Mm-hmm.
My dad waited for me outside the locker room. And when I got out there, he pulled open the program and said, art major? I said, didn't mom tell you? He says, no. I said, you got a problem with that? He's like, yeah, I do. And as a matter of fact, come Monday morning, you're going to change this major to finance, or we're going to pull you out of school.
Wow.
Ooh.
Well, this is still back in the day when things were done differently, right?
And I'm right.
So I went to we did back then have a academic counselor for the football team.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to him and I told him exactly that same story.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, okay, just show up at the business school on Monday morning, ask for Dr. Brown, and everything can be taken care of.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, so obviously they must have had some drop ads, or kids drop out or whatever, and
right.
I had shown that I was going to at least be sticking around, and plus I was on the football team. So that's how I got in the business school. And when I got in the business school, I started taking more finance classes, and I like finance.
Mm-hmm.
And also I broke both of my hands at the same time. So I couldn't draw and for art anyway, cause I got crushed in goal line defense.
Mm.
And,
how did they get crushed? Did somebody stepped on or something?
No,
or?
Between two helmets.
Ah, I see.
So my thumbs were not, I actually played with casts on both thumbs.
Jeez.
But I, so I stuck around for 4 years. I got a finance degree. I loved it. But you know, the best part about it was, guys, is that because I was really, I generally love art and I'm good at it. Mm-hmm. I look at everything from a different point of view than the rest of the crowd. So I don't get caught with a bunch of the groupthink. I'm usually on the outside, contrarian like looking in. Mm-hmm. And that's really done me well in my career because I've really gotten hit hard with a lot of people that put on the same position. So that looking, you know, thinking with a different side of your brain, I think is really, and also marketing wise and brand wise, you know, walking around wearing this black and white jacket, looking like a, you know, I look like an idiot. That's because that's the art major of me coming out, because I know it attracts eyeballs, attention, and it's what got me on TV, you know? So, all of it worked out for a reason.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And it's just, it's a brand, you know, and even when we tried to come up with a logo for Tractor Tuesday, it's gotta be a brand, like almost a cattle brand. You see it, you recognize it. It is something, you know, and it's just, that's what we were going for there. But, you know, something that you and me have in common outside of, you know, maybe a short-lived run in college doing some things that we might regret to our bodies. Something I heard you say on an interview that I thought was just absolutely hysterical that you had to admit to later on is we both have stolen back our own automobiles from an impound lot. And if you got about 38 seconds here, I'd love to hear that story because I can tell you mine afterwards. I think mine is, it might be a little bit better because I never got caught. So I think that's...
I didn't get caught either.
Oh, okay.
But I, but when I called my old man the next morning, he says, well, you know, it's in 40 years, it's going to be funny. Right now you're in a heap load of trouble. So yeah. I went down to the Boulder Police Department and turned myself in, and they put an orange jumpsuit on me and threw me in a cell.
Oh, wow.
And I got charged with them because I had to cut five locks. It was a Boulder Police impound lot way out East Boulder. So it wasn't really anywhere near the city.
Yeah.
But because I had to cut five locks, I was breaking and entering five times. I took my car back, which was technically their property. So that was Grand Theft Auto. So I had five felonies, punishable 75 to 125 years.
Oh my goodness.
And so that went over like a fart in church, if you can imagine at home.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, I pled down to a misdemeanor and I had no record, and one thing led to another where all I had to do was not get arrested for a year.
Yeah.
And it was just going to go on my record as, like, you know, stealing bubblegum from 7-Eleven,
right,
which is what
right.
happened. But you know, had I waited, it would have been much worse. They knew where I lived. They knew who's going to steal that car. It's, you know, only the owner. Right.
Yeah.
And so in the end, it's turned out to be a funny story, but in our business where I handle other people's money, mm-hmm. and we're so regulated, and broker check is a place people go look, but I've had to declare that story over 200 times.
Yeah.
I even have the microfiche from the Boulder County assessors or the Boulder County court.
Yeah.
Because I have to produce it every time, because there used to be a day when you guys would apply for a job or sometimes background check information that says, hey, have you ever been charged with a felony? Mm. Well, that's changed. I hate to tell you.
Yeah.
No, it's have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Oh, convicted. No. Okay.
Now it's changed to have you ever been charged? And I've been charged with five. So, it's just a whole heap. When people find out the story, it's funny.
Yeah.
But it's really led to a lot of extra aggravation on my behalf as far as paperwork goes, put it that way.
Well, it was very much premeditated. You had to physically cut locks. Is that what you're
I was at a party and I got my car towed and I was angry because it was the second time in a week it got towed. So, okay. I mean, I didn't have $100. It might as well have been $1,000 tow charge. I didn't have it. So went back to the paternity, put on all black sweatshirt, black jeans, black cap. I put, you know, shoe polish all over my face and got the lock cutters and went back and took my car.
Well, I guess you were the Angus guy that day. But, you know, for me, I never got caught. So I, same thing in college. This is, I hope there's a statute of limitations here, but 25 years ago, and woke up and my truck was gone. And by my truck, it was my dad's truck. And, you know, I'm clear out at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, of all places. And so I figure out where the tow yard is. I go there and I'm in there's 500 cars, 700 cars. These vehicles are coming out and the gate stays open for about 45 seconds. And this is like some Ocean's 11 stuff. So I've got the keys to the truck. I see my dad's truck. So I just hop in and I kind of start like a snake cruising through. The gate opens. I just drove right out. And 6 months later, what happened? they called my dad and said, hey, we're going to auction off this Chevy Silverado. We impounded it back in March or whatever it was. And this is like August time. My dad goes, what are you talking about? It's sitting right here in Nebraska. And so long story short, I never turned myself in. But yeah, again, I thought that was really funny that,
you know what? That's the first time I've ever had anybody say that we did the same thing. But anyway, so it makes me feel better that I'm not the only one.
Well, you know, it happens. And you're exactly right. In college, I mean, who's got anything? Maybe nowadays the guys, you know, some NIL money that might be a little bit different. They'd probably just throw a couple $100 bills like it's no big deal. But back when I was in college, it was a lot different. You know, I showed up with one pair of jeans and thank God for the athletic department. They kind of bailed me out with some used clothes. And, you know, at least I looked pretty rough out there. But, you know, it's interesting. And that kind of got you into finance because of it. You know, and honestly, it was a big step and a big progression in your life to kind of get you down the path you took, obviously. So, yeah, really exciting. So then from there, you know, you kind of got into the market at about the worst time ever, you know, around that 87. I think a lot of people probably older than Scott and I have a lot of horror stories back then, but couldn't have been easy to transition and potentially get into the worst time in history.
Well, I got out in spring of 88, I graduated with a finance degree, and there was no jobs in finance. Obviously, there was a crash of 87 that ruined it for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I took the first job I could get, and that job was trading options, or learning options, and then trading options, you know, being backed by a big backer at the Chicago Board of Trade. I mean, I had well over 200 rejection letters. It was just not going to happen, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I was parking cars. I was bouncing. I was breaking up cement. I was doing anything to stay alive. And I got an offer to make $125 a week for a trading firm that they would teach me how to trade puts and calls in the pit, you know. Yeah. And if I graduated, they had a program, and you had to take a test, and you had to get a certain score. And once that happened, you know, after a 6 or 8 month period, they put you in the pit, put money behind you, and you got a percentage of your takings.
Yeah,
that's the best I could do. So it was $125 a week. I got a raise to $135, and I celebrated like, you know, I won the lottery. But they were, you know, I was able to, they put money behind me, and I did well enough that shortly thereafter, they made me a partner in the firm and sent me to London. So it went pretty well.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, your track record out there, once you got to Europe, really gets interesting. And Scott Anderson, go ahead.
Yeah. What was your strategy were you mostly selling options? Were you doing, like, did you have a couple strategies that worked really well? Were you doing commodity options or stocks?
Yeah, they just put us in the corn pit, and all we were there really trained to do was take advantage of the different volatility levels that was, you know, being traded at each strike in the options. But so I didn't care about the structure as much as I cared about missed price options at those strikes. So if they were selling, out of the money calls at too cheap of volatility, I would hoover those up because somebody else was buying calls near them at a higher volatility. So you're constantly spreading, built, you know, working into butterflies, working out of butterflies, not because you're trying to put a butterfly on. You're just making markets and all those different strikes. You end up building inventory, and then you try to manage the inventory, which gets a little tricky. But it wasn't really that complicated. We were just there to make prices in options, and if they hit your bid or lifted your offer, then you manage the book after that. But we didn't have, we didn't come in and manage it like an investor would, right? Like sell the at the monies and see what happens. So we would always try to stay, you know, delta neutral, vega, theta neutral, all those option Greeks, and there was enough business then. I mean, we were coming off the I think it was drought of 88, I think, right? Yeah, I was in corn.
Or it had to be.
And so things went well, like I said. In 1989, I think it was, they sent me to London to be the European partner of the firm I was with in Chicago, which, you know, I was 23 years old. It wasn't too bad.
Wow. So, and when you got to London, was that mostly derivatives then, or what were
I went into the short sterling options pit. So that's like saying I went into euro dollar options.
Okay.
Short sterling is their currency. It was 90 day money, like euro dollars is 90 day money at the CME group. So I traded currency options for, I don't know, probably 7 years. And then I got a job. I got hired by Mizuho, which back then was called the Industrial Bank of Japan before they merged with Daiichi Kangol Bank and Nikko. And when I got that job, then my career really expanded, because then I was in charge of proprietary trading and the bank's money. I was, in charge of sales, bond sales, stocks. So I couldn't just do commodities. I did everything. Well, there's only three things we can do. We can trade in this world. And then there's derivatives, hundreds, maybe thousands of derivatives off of them. But you're either a commodities person, you're an interest rate person, or you're an equities person. Okay. Everything fits into those three silos. And so I was the manager, I'm managing director of the bank. So I had people working in all three of those sectors. So I had to quickly get up to speed. I was in my mid-30s, but I had to suddenly get to know everything about equities, everything about bonds and the bond markets. And then obviously I had a pretty good grounding in commodities, but it was kind of a pretty, pretty hairy, fast learning time. That's for sure.
Did you have any big windfall trades? Like, George Soros's famous trade where he broke the back of the.
Bank? That's a great question. In 1992, we had the currency crisis in Europe. I had probably one of the biggest short sterling options positions on in the city because I was young and dumb and I didn't really understand my risk. But it was severe enough that there used to be a firm in Chicago called Collins Commodities and Rosendahl Collins. You probably heard of them. That was Bob Collins. And Bob Collins took me under his wing. I was his acolyte, but I was trading his money in London. My position was big enough when that currency crisis started to unfold that he made me stay on the line, an open line with him while I was in the pit, because he was so afraid of his money and how much money I had at risk. I mean, I'm talking millions of dollars 1992, I was 26 years old. It was an insane amount of risk I had on. And actually, it's the first time in my life I've almost fainted because of what was happening. But if you can imagine, I walked into the pit on a Wednesday morning and the interest rates were 5%. 10% then in London. The London bank base rate was 10%. Here, right now, they just cut rates today. We're at 3.5%, okay? So this is back then. It's 10%. And then at some point during the day, George Soros and his quantum fund was trying to break the Bank of England because the Bank of England was trying to defend the pound sterling within the European exchange rate mechanism. I don't want to get into the weeds on that, but just know that we had to keep a higher interest rate in our country, in England, versus what the country really demanded, because we were going through a recession, but they kept interest rates high to keep their sterling in the exchange rate mechanism. It's really kind of going counterintuitive with going against each other. But to make a short story too long, I had so much risk on, and I was trading. I mean, there was points I did not know if I was up or down seven figures. And in the end, it was my best day ever. I had seven figure swings, but I ended up to the good. As the years have unfolded, I come to find out that George Soros wanted to break the government, the English government and the Bank of England, because he thought what they were doing was pretty stupid, which it was. They were keeping their interest rates too high to defend their pound sterling in the exchange rate mechanism rather than cut interest rates because they were in the middle of a recession. So he thought there's no way that they're going to win at this game. So he plowed all in trying to break the Bank of England with his options trades. And a lot of them were hitting the short sterling options pit, of which where I was trading. Now, George Soros had another man that worked with him. You might know who this guy is, Stanley Druckenmiller. He's like Joe Namath in the finance world. But Stanley Druckenmiller still is involved and he's still very active. But they had a young kid in the office who was 26, just a couple years older than me. I didn't know this at the time, but Stanley Druckenmiller felt as though that they were taking too much risk on and trying to break the Bank of England on that Wednesday. It was like September the 17th of 1992, I think. It's been imprinted, I think, on my brain. But anyway, Stanley Druckenmiller told George he thinks they should slow down. It was getting a little bit too aggressive. They were really risking a lot of their own capital, and he didn't like the position that the firm was putting themselves in. But they had a young intern who had just accepted a full-time job with the Quantum Fund at the time that was telling George Soros, no, we got him right where we want him. Put the pedal to the metal. We can do this. And George suddenly believed in this kid and said, Stanley, I think this kid's right. We're going to do it. So they just opened up the door, Katie barred the door. They really plied on their position and ultimately won. They broke the Bank of England. And it was the first time that a hedge fund had ever made $1 billion in one day. Wow. First time ever. And that young intern who just accepted the full-time job there at the Quantum Fund in London, his name was Scott Besson.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
So I was taking the other side of the Secretary of the Treasury's trades back in the day when we were both in London, 30 some odd years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, incredible. That's probably one of the most legendary trades of all time.
So that day we went in, I was 10% interest rates. They raised them to 12. The place went, it was pandemonium, a 200 basis point raising rates. Then they raised them to 15% by about noon. So 5% higher in one day. And then at 4 o'clock, right before the bell rang at 4:02, they cut them back down to 10%, gave up, said, you win, you broke us. Wow. So that is, I'll never see another market like that in my entire life. In one day, they raised rates 5% and cut them 5%.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely one for the books right there, and you actually lived it.
Yeah. Row crop, livestock, market talk, policy hawks, uptime, downtime, on time, ag news, markets, weather, land prices, public notice. If it matters, it's here. TractorReport.com, harvesting the day's top stories. TractorReport.com.
What year did you end up moving back to the States then?
I was there for, I was there from 89 to 02.
Okay.
I came back for 10 years, 13 years, and I went back from 2015 to 2020. So all in all, I spent 16 years over there, but basically a 10-year stint, or 11-year stint, and a 5-year stint.
Okay. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, it's, Scott Anderson and myself were more so gypsies, in our 20s or before we came back to the farm operation. I couldn't imagine having to make those types of lifestyle changes and, especially going back over the pond like that. Did you prefer being in England, or are you happy to be back home in the States?
It's been great to see my family, to get back around my family. As I've gotten older, it's been better to see my family, but back when I was younger, I loved traveling, and it was great to be able to have money and travel while your body was healthy. I used to, you go to Venice, you go to Paris, you go to Milan, you go to all these beautiful places in Europe, and I'm 30 and I have money and we're enjoying ourselves. And I would always say, God, it must suck to see these Americans getting off these big coaches and they can barely walk. They're in their late 60s, early 70s, and they can't enjoy like, my wife and I could at the time, because we had some, the markets were good. We had extra income so that we could afford to go have fun, and we could run around because we were still healthy and, our bodies weren't beat up. And I remember saying to myself, it's unfortunate, that's in the time of the life they have the money to go do it, but their body isn't complying. Right. We got lucky that we had both those things lined up for us. So I do like Europe because I love traveling. Mm-hmm. I'm just getting off of, I had a lot of work done on my knees from the football over the last 6 months. So I'm getting back in shape here so I can start to travel again myself. But travel is one of my hobbies. And it was a lot more fun to be in Europe traveling because the distance, the flight between, say, Chicago to Des Moines, puts you in a totally different culture, totally different, and I love history and I love culture. So that's one of the big reasons why I liked it over there. And ultimately you miss your family, so you want to come back to the States at some point in time. But I could have spent more time over there. I probably will retire part of the year over there myself. Cause if you're there, I was there from, the age of 23 to 36. I mean, that's when you make all your professional friends.
Exactly.
And all the weddings I was at, and all the head weddings of all, the bar mitzvahs and the baptisms and all the, I just have a whole nother life over there that I don't get to see as much. Mm-hmm. Thank God for the likes of Facebook and WhatsApp and FaceTime, so I could keep up to date with all those people. But I will definitely spend 3 to 6 months a year there when I retire in the next 6 or 7 years for the rest of my life, because I've got a big social circle there as well.
So would you base that around the London area, or where would you call your second home?
No, I love London. We lived in London I've always lived in London, but I also always had a house out in the country in near agricultural land, like farmland. I don't know if maybe you do, but our farm here in the States was just outside of Galena, Northwest Illinois, where it's very hilly, a lot like Eastern Tennessee is here. Mm-hmm. And so there's a place about 90 miles west of London called the Cotswolds. Okay. It's ancient lands, but it's very hilly. And it just reminds me of Eastern Tennessee or Galena or Joe Davies County, Northwest Illinois, across the river from Dubuque, if you know Iowa.
Yeah, right.
And so I've always had a place there. So if I went back, you know, for 3 months or 6 months every year, I would probably go towards the countryside rather than the city, just because there's nothing better than a good old English pint on a nice warm day in a 900-year-old pub. You know, I got married over there. I got married in a church that was 1,100 years old, and we had a reception in a pub that was 800 years old, and both those buildings weren't considered old, you know? So,
yeah.
That's amazing.
Just
we beautiful. Have kids?
Yeah, we got three kids now. So, you know, I have two grandkids now for that. So that's another great reason to come back. I got a 6-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. So that's been a lot of fun. And they were just down here for Thanksgiving. So we get to, I mean, it's all working out, but at the same time, you know, they're going to get older and they get involved with school and activities. And that's when my wife and I think we'll go back over there and spend at least 3 months just to make sure that I keep that social circle going. And a lot of those people are very, very close to me.
Oh, no, that's awesome. Yeah, it's cool you get those types of experiences and then just the opportunity to go back. I've never been to Europe until about 3 weeks ago. I went to Agritechnica and flew into Frankfurt, Maine. We've got our lead back-end developer lives in Frankfurt. Took the train over to Hanover, and yeah, you're exactly right. I wish I would have had the time, and my wife and me were super pregnant. We've got maybe 4.5-5 weeks till our next baby comes. So she couldn't go with me out there and would have loved to explore a little bit, but I don't like sightseeing by myself. You know, I feel like I see something beautiful and it's just, I want to tell her or the kids about it. And, you know, so I felt kind of guilty and even bumped up some of my meetings so I could fly back a little bit early, but yeah, definitely on the bucket list. But the problem is, you know, I said this on our first episode, when you're the oldest first time dad in Nebraska, you know, God dang, I'm going to be 50 by the time she's done with me having children. Well, what does that make me by the time our kids are all out of the house and we're empty nesters? You know, I'm going to be pushing 70. So I got to get my stuff together so I can walk around a little bit better and do my thing out there. But no, Scott, it's awesome having you here. And, you know, one thing that we all love about you and your shows and the information that you put out there, you know, and I've heard you say this at least 5 or 6 times over the past year and a half, even, you know, that farmers are really the most underserved that you can really find. And it's just as far as investors. And I think if you had any sort of advice, and I complain about this too, because as a farmer, I even said to Scott Anderson here last week on the episode that what I dislike about farming is, yeah, I mean, we're supposed to be mechanics. We're supposed to, you know, be able to tend the land and be, you know, good stewards and all the things we're supposed to do. But now in the 21st century here, we're supposed to be professional traders. And it simply irritates me. You know, it's just, there's a lot of these old timers that they literally sell their commodity right over the scale. Doesn't matter what the prices are. They just roll with the punches. Year in, year out, they might be the happiest. They probably have the most hair on their head, and they just do things simple. You know, now you got these guys like me that, you place a put, do a call, X, Y, Z. Yeah. And it's like, man, I've got a lot of things to worry about here, and I can't monitor the price of fertilizer, all these inputs, and it's nothing new. People want to attribute, in my opinion, to tariffs, but really farming has not been sustainable as far as an independent guy since 2021. You know, and that's really where we're at with it. And that's something that all the farmers, I think, really appreciate is, you know, you understand, I think, more so because of your background. And, you know, really, how should, you know, fellow producers really think about everything going on with the disruptions, other geopolitical events? I mean, do you have any advice for the simple farm guy here in Nebraska or Iowa?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, it's we've had obviously three bad years in a row here, and that's what anybody can't really. It's hard to really stomach that, and you know, not any business can have back to back, you know, bad years like that. But I would say that, you know, in your story about a lot of guys that just they pull it out of the field and run it over the scale. Mm. Generally speaking, they also own the land outright. You know, they don't have a ton of overhead, so they can do that. Mm. I know a lot of guys that do that still, and I think in today's day and age, you have to work with somebody that you can make your marketing as efficient as possible. There are a couple of times, you know, generally speaking, I think the last 2 years, not including this year, but 2 years before, it was really, maybe this year too, but you know, it's really hard when the high of the year for corn or beans is like January or February. I mean, that really doesn't give you a chance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people out there don't understand that you know, you don't have a ton of places to buy your seed, your fertilizer, or even get your labor or whatever, you know, your input costs. You're having to face a bunch of monopolies on one end. Mm-hmm. And then you try to manage and market that crop and hedge as best you can in the middle. And then at the end of it, you have you can only drive to a couple monopolies to get rid of it. Right. So you're a price taker on both ends, and they're both monopolies. And in the middle, that's your only chance there to see if you can make the situation any better for yourself. And that really puts you under the gun. And there's not a lot of room for error. And I absolutely understand that. So I would say, you know, I'm not here. My show, and it goes what I said earlier, but my show is not here to tell people how to farm. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a 5-hour news program, Market Day Report, on RFD TV. If you want to watch that, that's going to be much better than what I'm going to give you as far as, you know, for my program as far as farming goes. But what I want to do is I want to teach the farmer how to make money from the money they make farming. Mm-hmm. Because there's an opportunity there as well. And on top of that, this is true because I've been all over the world. You know, I was managing director of the biggest Japanese bank in London. I spent a ton of time in the Far East, Tokyo. I did a lot of business for Consolidated Grain and Barge. Probably heard of those guys out of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I've spent a ton of time, you know, Seoul, Korea, Singapore. Tokyo, I don't know how many times. And every big trading room I've been to, you know, I worked for Deutsche Bank, so I was in Frankfurt a lot. I spent, a week a month in Frankfurt for years. Mm-hmm. I would go into these big banks into their big trading rooms. And when I'm talking big trading rooms, I'm talking football field or bigger, where they've got everybody deploying their capital. And go back to the three silos. You know, you got the equity guy. He's got a budget. More people trade equities in this world. It's a much bigger product. So if they hit their budget, you know, the 20 guys on that desk get to split $50 million. Mm-hmm. All right. So these guys are walking away with $2.5-3 million each. And then you go one step down is the bank, the bond traders, the interest rate guys, the currency guys, anything that is affected by interest rates. Mm-hmm. They hit their budget, $20 million. Well, they've got 20 guys on their desk. They all might leave with $1 million, maybe whatever. And these are pretty close numbers, by the way.
Yeah.
And then you get to the commodities desk. They hit their number, but the commodities aren't as big of products as bonds in the world or stocks in the world. So you hit your numbers, you get like a new truck and then a bunch of fertilizer in the bed. You know, that's their bonus. And it was but you know what I found out is that these were the wealthiest people in the world. I'm on Wall Street in New York and I'm in Lombard Street in London fighting for all these customers. Had I known back then the amount of money that was out in middle America, that's when I say the modern American farmer is probably the most underserved, wealthiest investment class in the world because of the balance sheets that I see when I sit down with some of these people that own 5,000 acres of $20,000 an acre, you know, land in Iowa or Illinois. I mean, their balance sheets are massive.
Right.
And so I think if I had to do it over again, I would have gone after that group of people because, you know, we all know the Board of Trade, 5,000 bushels is a contract. So when it comes to hedging your land and your product, you're not doing a ton of volume, okay? But because of the wealth and the balance sheet of a middle America, they're trading everything else. You know, they're trading, you know, that stocks, bonds, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I want that. I want to, you know, I would have gone after that business, right? And that's what I'm trying to help them with. So I have some of the best minds in the business on my show. And these guys pick up a lot of business from middle America, from very wealthy farmers that call these big bond guys in New York or wherever I talk to them. And it works for everybody. The guys that come on my show get new business. And the farmer finally gets some good representation.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think that's what a lot of these guys are appreciating. Some of that insight just, it comes off being a little bit more authentic, I think, because of your experiences. And I think for the quality and the caliber of guests that you have currently, you know, especially on the Cow Guy Close, I think that's really, you know, guys love to hit it home at the end of the day. And then they can get on to, you know, maybe a late dinner and then go back to work.
Yep.
Let's hear about Tractor Tuesday from a customer, Mitchell Fagan.
With it being the buyer's premium, we got what we wanted, and that was the number we got. What number we sold it for, that's what we're getting. That's what matters. It's not like, oh, we got to take 3% off, 4% off. Okay, so what do we need? Do we need 250? Do we need 260? What have you? And so it was simple. It's like, this is a number we got. That's what we're going to get a check for. I would for sure recommend Tractor Tuesday. I would tell anybody, get out there, talk to Tractor Tuesday, try to get your equipment sold that you need to, and you're going to get the most bang for your buck.
TractorTuesday.com.
Do you offer like consulting or coaching or any sort of service like that for producers?
Well, starting next year, we've had a ton of interest that way. So that's something we're going to start in about 3 weeks. So,
oh wow,
yeah. I mean, my inbox on social media keeps getting flooded, but I'll absolutely be doing that at the beginning of the year.
Do you see that focus primarily on the marketing side of the farm?
Well, I mean, with your crops, sure. I mean, there's a dime a dozen from, look.
Yes.
Because I have the show that I have, everybody that's got a newsletter or markets this or markets that, I get flooded with all that stuff all the time. Market Minute, all this garbage all the time, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And don't get me wrong, these guys work hard and they put some good stuff. But there are some things that are better than others. Like there is better pizza than others, right? Not all pizza is bad. But I would want to be, I would be looking at doing something more of the whole package, not just your corn, wheat, and beans. What are we doing with the money over here? How are you handling this? What is your 401k look like? Do you have money that you can invest in here? I would want to do the whole marketing thing, not just your corn, wheat, and beans.
So like a wealth strategist.
Yes, in a way. Yes. Wealth advisor.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, I see the same opportunity there. I mean, I do a ton of off-farm investing from multifamily hotels. I'm a partner in a couple hedge funds as well. One of my closest mentors runs a hedge fund in London and New York, and I have most of my liquid net worth there. But I mean, there's just so few opportunities to reinvest into the farm. And the only time you want to reinvest in the farm is when nobody's got any money.
Right.
And all your commodity markets are bad, or they've been bad for 3 or 4 years. Then there's an opportunity to maybe acquire some farmland at a good price. Otherwise, farmers only know farming and they just buy tons of machinery, which depreciates, which destroys their balance sheet on the short-term assets. All their cash is gone, but they don't have a tax liability. I mean, there's just such terrible management when it comes to the balance sheets, the cash flow from farmers and the off-farm investments. If it wasn't for off-farm investments for me, this year would be extremely painful.
Right. Yeah. There's an opportunity there. And plus, I come from that background too. So hopefully I have a little legitimizing factor, right? Because my dad and I, we would have people come out to our farm that didn't know that we were in the markets ourselves. And they're trying to get your business. And you're like, listen, Joe, unfortunately, we know more than you know about what you're talking about. I appreciate the call, but there aren't a lot of people like that. So I'm in the business to help people. I'm in the business to make things better for people. So like you said, I was in high school when we had the last disaster in the early 80s. Remember? Farm Aid and Waylon and Willie and all the stuff going on back then. I got to tell you, unfortunately, because we had capital, my dad managed things pretty well, and I learned from him that our farm expanded fivefold because we just bought the guy's house next door and took the fence down.
Yeah.
I mean, we literally bought five farms doing that.
Mm.
It was hard to do it because we knew that.
I'm sure. Yeah.
They were happy to have it go to people they knew, but at the same time, it was just a disaster emotionally. I mean, there's not probably a lot of guys that can talk about that even left anymore, right? Yeah. So I have direct line experience with those types of things and those types of emotions, which help in crafting a plan for people because I understand, I understand what it's like to be a sixth generation farmer. And am I going to lose this whole thing because I didn't hedge right? I mean, the pressure sometimes is just insurmountable.
Well, do you see any of this repeating? And I know it's always different, and I think there's always different variables, different factors. Something my dad is trying to beat in my head right now is, we started losing money in 78, 79. That's why the tractorcade rolled. That's, you know, what happened on the cusp of probably 1981, roughly. The good farm ground in my neck of the woods was probably between 2,000 and maybe 3,200 an acre. And then next thing you know, interest rates kind of hit. You got into the mid-80s, International and Case have their merger. They're literally repainting tractors to try to sell again, or honestly, for the first time. Yeah, it's a disaster. And then it took until basically 2003, maybe 04 into 05, to get the land values back to where they were. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, history, you know, doesn't necessarily repeat, but it rhymes. But what is different this time, you know, this level of volatility, are we ever going to stabilize over the next few years? Or is, you know, volatility, is that the new normal?
Well, you're going to have, you're definitely going to see the volatility. That's not going to change. But what the biggest difference between now and 1982 mm-hmm. is interest rates, you know, in 81. I mean, we got up to 19%. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what killed everybody. You know, if you were leveraged at all, you got smoked when everything, you know, a lot of those floating rate loans, you just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so that's what really hurt everybody then. So it's, the key is going to be interest rates. We just cut them today. The Fed funds rate went to 3.5 to 3.75. Mm-hmm. The 10-year yield's still above 4%, but that probably will come down to somewhere in the high threes. And then when that happens, everybody's mortgage, or the opportunity to get a mortgage, maybe in the low sixes or maybe high fives will have, that'll help get some of the stuff going. But it's going to be the interest rate, I think, is the key, because inflation's the key.
Yeah.
The agricultural world has benefited from inflation too, by the way. I mean, look what happened to some of these land prices. And you've seen the same numbers that I've seen in Iowa, Illinois, and mm-hmm. Nebraska. And so there is, you know, those balance sheets have exploded with you know, inflation. So there are some good things, and you can turn that into capital. You can borrow against yourself. And I mean, that's what I'd like to talk to guys about, but that's for a whole nother show, I suppose.
Well, and real briefly, you know, if there was a major windfall, a producer could capitalize on maybe some of these excessive, it could be said, land values. You know, if a farmer wakes up one day and he's got $11 million available, what is the very near-term strategy for them to deploy that capital to their advantage?
Well, I mean, I would say I would look at what I'm making. What's my return on capital when I, you know, in the field? What can I get out of that, whatever it is out there? And or if not, then I got to turn around and say, you know, there are ways to keep money safe, but still, you know, investing in some dividend earning stocks. You could throw in a little bit of the 10-year bond in there if you want to ladder some bonds, and it doesn't have to be an all or nothing approach. But, you know, I don't think it's ridiculous to think about getting a 10, 11, or 12% return if you're halfway smart with your money when it comes to the stock market. So you can get a straight 10 to 12% return with the stocks. You can add some value to that with some dividend earning stocks. You can, if you're worried, you throw in a little bit of the bond market in there and guarantee yourself 4, 4.5% on some of it for a little while. I mean, and that's probably going to be a better return than if you had it out in the field. I mean, because of all the other things that go into it. So, I talk about it a lot. I'm going on the speaking tour, you know, beginning of this year. I've already got, you know, I'm getting booked up that way. But I throw that in there. I mean, these are all the things that you have to take a look at. Because I was in Lamar's, Iowa, and I sat down and had a beer with a guy that had, 35,000 acres of Iowa prime farmland. Wow. I mean, how much is that guy worth?
Oh, half a billion, so, very easily, yeah.
I mean, it's like he can leverage that, right? Yeah. And not in a dumb way that if he does have interest rate exposure or something like that, you know, you can do some smart things with that. That's the part that really gets me going, because it's more creative. That goes back to full circle being an artist again, right? So there's a lot of creative ways to boost your ROI off your, you know, rather than just let it sit out in the land.
Yeah, definitely. No, and that's something I think a lot of farmers need to really look into. And some of us have some of these unique situations, you know, going on every day, every week, you know, these data centers, these, you know, major purchases. And it wasn't just the carbon CO2 pipelines. There's a lot of major plays where groups are coming in 2030, you know, 32,000 an acre is kind of this headline you keep hearing out of a couple of counties in Iowa, you know, to reinvest. And I think, you know, R. Scott here with New Age Ag Supply, way better versed than the average farmer really could be with investment. The problem is we're thick in the skull, and we know how to put seeds in the dirt. And it's just, it is kind of hard to get that open pipeline into some of these ideas, you know, and strategies to reinvest and to try to benefit the operation. And I think, you know, with all that said, I mean, you know, just diversifying, I think that's something you're really standing behind. But, you know, I don't know, Scott, do you have any other ideas as far as what the cow guy might be able to provide for the average or more savvy farm investor?
Well, I mean, I definitely, you know, I was an adjunct professor of finance at DePaul University. I've run big banks in Europe. I mean, I'm not going to be your run of the mill broker, you know, StoneX or RJ O'Brien. Nothing mm-hmm. wrong with those places. Don't get me wrong, but I'm going to bring something to the table that, you know, and I think outside the box, but not risky outside the box, just different asset allocation outside the box, because okay. I've seen a lot more than people, and it's not because I'm any smarter. I just have been exposed to more. Mm-hmm. And I can tell just by the way Scott speaks that he's obviously much more than the average investor. And I can just tell by the things that have come out of your mouth today, Scott, you clearly have a better handle on it than most of the people out there in ag land. But just because you haven't been exposed doesn't mean you're stupid. And a lot of people might think that, and they might get embarrassed about it, but ignorance is not something to be embarrassed about. It's just you haven't been exposed. So you can be that guy with 30,000 acres and not be exposed, but be very, very smart and be missing a lot of opportunity. And yeah. So the opportunities that I would still say, I mean, you want to somehow benefit a little bit from this artificial intelligence movement. But everybody's different. So I have to put that out there as a caveat. So I don't want to get in trouble with regulators. So each person's got a different set of risks and what they like and what they don't like. But I'm telling you, if you get with the right people, there are absolutely ways you can take advantage, get a bigger return on your money, but you're not putting your neck on the line to do it.
Yeah. No, understood. No, I think that's great advice for anybody paying attention today to what we've been talking about. And, you know, kind of a more of a personal question. How many of the cow guy coats and apparel is your closet full of the print, or what's
it? Well, it's funny that, you know, as the years go by, it's funny how when I put them in the closet, sometimes I pull them out, they shrink in the closet somehow. I don't know how that happens.
I got the same problem, you know.
And so there's problems. I used to give them away. Like when I meet celebrities, I would always bring an extra one with me. So, you know, like Stuart Murney's got one on Fox. Chris Christie, the ex-governor of New Jersey got one. Yeah. I used to give them out. And then, I don't know, I've probably worn about 50. I only have about 5 or 6 in my arsenal right now. But like I said, you know, that my closet has just got a bad way of shrinking stuff on me as I've gotten older. So I do have somebody that makes them for me. And, and my father, bless his soul, he's not with us anymore, but he used to name her Omar the tent maker, you know. So I just lay down on a piece of cloth and they trace around me.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did you first start donning the jacket? Was that in the early 2000s then?
My dad started to wear it when we first built the dairy barn in the late 1970s. Okay. So my father wore a black and white cow jacket on the floor way before I ever.
Yeah.
And so when I came back from London in 2001, he retired. He got Alzheimer's and retired. Yeah. And my dad and I were very close. And I thought it'd be really cool if I wore my dad's jacket as an homage to him.
Yeah.
You know, just like a game worn jersey, you know. And, so I put it on one day and I'm like, well, unfortunately or fortunately, it doesn't matter. But that's about the time all the hedge fund money started to come into the commodities markets. They've always been in interest rates and equities.
Yeah.
But we had billions of dollars from New York suddenly flood into the commodity markets in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, they'd come to the Board of Trade and they'd say, what's the fat guy with the cow jacket doing on in the middle of that pit? We want to talk to that guy. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how the media thing got going.
Okay.
Is that they wanted to talk to the guy in the cow jacket that was. And so I just, dumb luck, I put it on right before the media came into the business.
Okay. Well, good timing. I think it all worked out the way it's supposed to. And
it's really cool marketing. I mean, I wear a lot of camouflage. That's kind of my trademark. But
So now I was in London for a long time, and one of my really good friends there is like he's a C-level celebrity, you know, like a Billy Bush kind of a guy, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's like, you know what? He could see the ratings on Fox when I go on, and he's like, look, you can't ever not be wearing something black and white cow related when you go out in public. I don't care if it's Sunday morning, because you've got a brand now, and you can't let it down to happenstance. But if you just wear the white glasses, but you got a jean jacket on, people are going to go, I know that guy. But he says, if you have something black and white on, they'll know right away. And so it's worked. I've been in Tokyo, been recognized. I've been in Venice or on the canals and been recognized. As long as you wear something. So I have this, you know, Rosie is my tailor. She makes me a bunch of cow shirts all the time, all different types, but all cow related. So I never do not have something cow related on. It's almost an obsession, but it works because it keeps the brand going.
Yeah. No, that's really awesome. Well, hey, Scott, you got to keep us posted when you actually launch some of the consulting services. I think there's going to be a lot of these Midwestern Corn Belt and Plain State farmers that are going to be very interested in the opportunity to get more of this personalized feedback, you know, and any other products you have to offer in the near future. And, you know, sure. I guess with all that said, I mean, is there one message to the average corn and bean farmer or livestock guy that you'd like to maybe convey their way today?
Well, no, I mean, I just know, I know it's been tough and it's not their fault. I mean, you can probably make things better if you have got a really good plan and you're efficient when it comes to your marketing. But, you know, when you've got 2 or 3 years, when the high of the year is January, February, and who's going to pull the trigger on their crop then? Yeah. I don't know a lot of people that do. There's a few that did. Obviously, you get paid well if you had that. But I understand. So this, when the times are tough like this, I would say this. And my father would say it all the time. Just make sure you're allowed to stay in the game. Don't take any risks that knock you out of the game. Mm-hmm. You want a return of your capital right now, not a return on your capital. When things start to loosen up and get better, then we can start talking about getting a return on your capital. But right now, you want a return of your capital.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
That's a great point. Make sure you can pay your bills first, and then we'll talk about getting rich.
You know, and I'll leave you with this. I traded over the, you know, the currency crisis in London. There was a mini crash of 1988 after the big crash of 87. And time again, I traded them myself, and I can relay the same thing, but everybody would always say, the people that didn't blow out on the day of the crash and were allowed in the building the next day because they made it through, that's when the real money was made. Millions of dollars were made the second day, the day after, because they're still in the game. Everybody else got knocked out. So you want to just don't put yourself in a position where you get taken out of the game. Because the real money's made right after the storm. And just keep that in mind, whatever your decision is when it comes to finance, because I saw it happen to myself. I've heard more stories about it happening in 1992 when I was trading against Scott Besson. You want to make sure that you don't put yourself in a position where they take you out of the game, because then you never get another chance to get to bat. Yeah. But if you always can stay in the game, man, you're going to get back up against that juicy pitcher that lays a, you know, big softball over the plate, and you can hit some home runs and start, you know, scoring some money.
Yeah. Well, no, that's great motivation for everyone.
That's a great, great perspective. Yeah.
Well, hey, Scott,
definitely got to have Scott back on when he gets a little bit more of this, this wealth management structure put together. Cause man, that's going to be powerful. I mean, that's probably the biggest opportunity in agriculture on the farmer level is just advising those guys setting up.
I think so. I agree.
Yep. Yeah. And we've got some interesting contacts that Scott introduced me to a couple different hedge funds. And, you know, it's interesting. We're looking to diversify a little bit more strategically and find a way to mitigate. And most importantly, you know, about the game, you know, I hate to say it, and some people don't like it when I say this, but anymore, farming has almost evolved into a sport for land ownership. And I think that's exactly where we are. It's just, we're trying to continue to play and we don't plan on going anywhere, but so many things work against us that maybe we can even the plane a little bit here by getting creative. And number one, getting some great advice. You don't have to be an expert if you can rely on the expert. So,
yeah.
I mean, everybody's got a good idea about how to build a house, but you don't do it. You get an expert to do it, right? And that's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, hey, well, Scott, I think this is a good place. And no, I appreciate your time today. It was awesome. Just, you know, getting a general overview. Hopefully more of the younger farmers become familiar with who we're talking to today, because I think there's more of a need. You know, there's not that many producers in my neck of the woods from 40 to 50 but there's a heck of a lot of them that are over 50 and in their early 30s, like my wife's age. Seems like that tends to be more of the concentrated age. I think they're more open to the message that you know, folks like yourself are putting out there. And again, you know, can you just explain to the audience where everybody can catch you at Monday through Friday and online on socials? Oh, yeah.
Well, you watch the Cow Guy close. It's Central Time. It's 12:30 to 1:30 Central, 1:30 to 2:30 Eastern. RFD TV every day. But if you don't get RFD TV, shame on you, number one. But number two is if you go to Scott the Cow Guy, my Twitter page, and my LinkedIn page, Scott Shelody LinkedIn, and Scott Shelody on Facebook, I repost the show every day without commercials. Each segment I put up there on its own, so you don't have to suffer through all the commercials, and you can watch the show that way too.
No, that'd awesome. Be great. And honestly, if you ever get a promo code to shill out there for, you know, maybe the streaming side of RFD Live, there's some great content on there, and we'd love to help push the message any way we could. All right,
brother, appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, Scott Shelody, I appreciate your time. And
yeah, again, thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thanks again for your time. And again, we'll finish this up here. Tractor Tuesday Live. Appreciate it.
All right, Zach, Scott, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Well, it's not far to my grandpa's. At least it's not for me.